I don't know about you, but lately I've been feeling somewhat despondent about America. Not hopeless, but certainly very upset about our failure to look at problems square in the face. Some of this may have been exacerbated by the very long 4th of July weekend, but I'm starting to feel that we're not really being honest about what ails us, that we don't want to confront unemployment or racism or sexism or a government that spies on us without our consent or the erosion of our constitution or growing income inequality or why we aren't using more diplomacy to sort out the mess in Syria, Egypt, Israel, Lebanon, name your fucked up country of choice, or why we aren't kinder to each other or more willing to take risks or listen to viewpoints we despise or simply cannot understand. But then you talk with someone like An Chi Minh, and you realize that as bad as it is here, it could be a hell of a lot worse. I mean, here is a woman who toiled in labor camps, who starred in Chairman Mao's propaganda films, and who was one of many proletarians blamed for the failure of the Cultural Revolution upon Mao's death. She was punished, she was labeled an outcast, yet she still managed to get to America. And when she got here, she didn't know any English, but she worked very hard to learn the language and become a best-selling novelist. An Chi Minh has a new memoir out called The Cooked Seed. This is a sequel to Red Azalea, and this covers her time here in America. It involves some extraordinary sacrifices and hardships and the beginnings of forming a new family, and it should cause all of us to reflect on our common American predicament. We're all struggling, and it's important for us to listen to each other. I was very honored to talk with An Chi. She had a very tight schedule, but I was able to meet with her right when she came through New York, which was about a day. And the conversation you're about to hear gets into everything from being the hero of your own story, to toiling for nothing, to the uplifting power of Michael Jackson's music. And if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. You can check out more than 500 conversations with authors, filmmakers, other majestic souls at www.batsegundo.com. Please also visit us on iTunes, and if you like the show, feel free to rate and review us. Please also pass along word of this program, because that is what helps to keep this program going. But An Chi Minh is who we're about to talk with, and I think you will find this as inspiring as I did when I was talking with her. Again, it was a great honor to talk with someone who has lived a life I can only know through words and through listening, and I hope you will listen too. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm here with An Chi Minh, who is most recently the author of The Cooked Seed. An Chi, how are you doing?
Fine.
Yeah,
I'm glad I made the plane, because the limo in Houston, I was in Houston yesterday and delivered me to the wrong airport.
Oh,
and
they
I missed
did.
The plane. Yeah.
Well, what's Texas like? What's Houston? I've never actually been in Houston.
It's great. I was at the Asia House, mm-hmm. the new museum they built. It's fancy.
Oh, well, fantastic. So let's get into the book. Murray McCarthy once famously remarked that we all live in suspense, living from day to day, hour to hour. And this makes us the heroes of our own story. So when you wrote both Red Azalea and The Cooked Seed, my question to you is, what did you take to downplay your own heroine status? Is the judgment of whether you are a good person or not left up to the reader? Or is including such moments as the way you portray Lorianne, your daughter, or act as a landlord, are these open enough for the readers to judge for themselves?
I guess I will leave them to judge for themselves. For me, writing Red Azalea was a way to learn English.
Yeah.
And I believe that only when I write it and I have people correct me and I correct it and copy the text, would I learn English in a solid, effective way.
Yeah.
I did not think about anything else because I had nothing. What I wanted was the opposite. I wanted to write like American classmate. But I did not grow up with hamburgers. So amazing. I did not understand what McDonald's meant. So it was a fancy that they took me to Chicago Avenue in Chicago, the McDonald's for the first time.
Yeah.
And put on makeup for the first time. And I think I was just off the boat.
Yeah.
Nothing else. It was just survival, try not to be deported. With this one, the cook, the seed, I was way, it's the other, I was on the other end. Because I had been making living as an author for 25 years.
Yeah.
So I knew what I possessed.
Yeah.
It's just how far do I want to take the material? It's the issue of honesty.
Yeah.
And also bring my daughter into the picture and my divorce and everything. I feel that as an American writer, I realize I do not own my own material. And I had no right to own that. But it's a conflict. How far would I wanted to go? It was my daughter who said, "Mom, if you want to leave me anything, I want to leave me your story, but not the sugar-coated version."
So here's a question for you. If you don't own your own material, do you feel that the more English you know, the less you actually own it, the less private it may very well be in the act of writing? If Red Azalea came from this moment of almost purity where there was no expectation of audience, there was no expectation that it would be published, how do things change when you are sharing your story, both from an English standpoint and also from an audience standpoint?
I feel that it's the guilt that I was aware of being an author. I know my material. I know how to write by now. And I knew one thing, that if I don't tell the story, the second generation, like my daughter, if she decided to write a story about me, she will never get to where the real life I lived, because there's so much an immigrant mother would not want to leave behind that kind of, for example, my relationship with a pornography tape,
because
that was my only comfort, and it was the most difficult part to review, and I knew that no immigrant woman would want to reveal that. But for me, what I see is the cruelty of the loneliness that impaired me as a person. If you live 10 years in a storage like a mice, a city rat, and you're busy with trying to make a living, you have no relationship whatsoever, but you are human. And this material would get lost. And I felt like I had a platform and for the voiceless.
Yeah. The bravery of revealing that masturbation, the sex video, and you also reveal how he also wanted to sell you the tape for $25 and he talked it down to $20. It was the least rented tape in that video store. But it also reminded me of how you conveyed affection and sex in Red Azalea with Jan, how you were both each other's imaginary boyfriends. And with that, it leads me to ask you, when you write about sex, it's interesting to me how it comes from this place of loneliness, almost as if that's the truest place to write about sex. You don't really write about sex in a pleasurable way, or even a romantic way. And I wanted to ask why that is, or is it possible that the way you write about sex is just the truest way you feel on the page? Just to actually be honest about the fact that a lot of people get into this because of loneliness, because of need, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you put it very well. Yes, in real life, it is almost dispassionate. It's a very cruel, matter of fact, survival mode. But as a literary material, it's the most romantic, the most sensuous way. Because that's the moment that you're dealing with yourself, the innermost. And also, you even with my relationship in the labor camp, it was almost you see each other and then you meet each other like a ghost, and nothing was said. It was just under the blankets. It was inside the mosquito net. And she was in love with a boy, and I was craving for boys, and we knew the price to date a man is execution, the punishment, the imprisonment. And we realized that we were in touch with our humanity, but there's the guilt over it. Yeah, you have to move on as human animals. So by accident, we discovered the poetry of God.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting because I was going to ask on a less austere note, you did read Love Story in Chinese translation. And I was wondering if that had any kind of impact upon your notion of romance or love or even sex. And also, you know, how did that notion change when you came to Chicago? I mean, was this one of the things that you had to adjust your own internal feelings for? Or?
It's quite bizarre. I do not read any Chinese romantic, anything that have that element.
Yeah.
Before the Cultural Revolution, which means before 1978. Mao died in 76.
Yeah.
And then that was 2 years later, the Western translations of first Western literatures, like Jane Eyre and Gone with the Wind, start to pour in the Chinese translations. But before that, the only book about relationship of man and woman was this medical book. It's called, the title is called 从头到脚,猴眼看人, from head to toe, looking from a monkey's eye.
Oh.
And there is I was reading it when I was 16, and the only sentence in the book that intrigued me was, I still remember, it says, the highest form of a revolution comradeship was the intercourse between a man and a woman. And I thought, whoa, what was it? What does it mean?
Yeah.
Highest form of revolutionary comradeship. And then the bizarre thing was, after I was picked by Madame Mao's people and to be featured in a propaganda film portraying Madame Mao's ideal proletarian beauty, and it was very much, the selection was like a Miss America, Miss Universe. It's just the measurements, the opposite. We have to have colors on our shoulders and hands to prove that we were real peasants and weather-beaten face and carry 300 pounds of manure. But after picked up and did the screen test, and I had never learned acting before, and all these things is like imitating Madame Mao's like a cartoonish opera. And Madame Mao decided the screenplay, the test is awful. We need to be educated.
Yeah.
So we were called to Beijing in the Madame Mao's private screening room and viewed her favorite movies, which featured, it's like, I remember one was like a Battle of Rome sort of thing, like Caligula, you know, it's really, yeah.
The Bob Guccione film?
Yeah, something like that, because I can't recall exactly, because that was, the translator was mumbling, so most of it was images. So we, for the first time from that forbidden time, primitive time of without any men, all of a sudden over that, you see the blue eyes people and turning your inside out. And even we had a sections of meetings on making sure we don't get mentally poisoned by watching this movie.
Yeah.
But I come to America, I all of a sudden realize that I'm not unfamiliar with these brown-eyed and blue people who are having orgies, you know. And it's really weird. And in Chicago, in my storage basement where I live alone, and with the promo film, and that kind of all things just stringed together.
Yeah.
It makes pretty interesting material.
And the name of the video was Sex Education, which also makes it quite interesting in light of these this idea of education in China as well.
Right. And
this is the gateway in.
Yeah, because the first time I was in the porno store, I actually was, because Christmas and Thanksgiving are my, especially Thanksgiving evening, the restaurants, nobody goes into the Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
So I was let off early, and it's the loneliest night. I couldn't go home, because if I gone back to China, I would not be able to get a visa back. That was a terror. So I wanted to treat myself with a movie. And I did not know inside the movie store, I stepped into the porno section. And that title, sex movie, was the least, you know, threatening. But inside, I know it's a cover. But yeah, because of that title, nobody borrowed that movie.
Yeah.
That's why the owner, after a few times, he tried to sell it to me.
Yeah. He was lucky he had you as a customer, I guess. Yeah, that was in stock. I wanted to talk about, because you brought up the Chinese restaurant and nobody being in there during Thanksgiving. And much of your life, your early life in America, is very much concerned with living the cheapest possible existence, calculating how much money you lose when you take the train to and from work. I mean, there's one chapter I don't want to give it away, in which you go straight to work after something extraordinarily terrible happens. And I was reading a story this morning about how 73% of Americans are now living paycheck to paycheck. This leads me to ask, well, this notion of saving, obviously your family was a big part of it, and wanting to make sure they had money, and also the guilt of trying to get them over to America. But where did you develop this very, very like no-nonsense approach to using money and saving it and wanting to accrue more of it? It's almost becoming less American, especially with our economy in the toilet right now. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess it's survival. If you're in that situation, and first of all, I think it has to do with it's a sense of gratitude. I mean, it is hard to work five jobs at the same time, but when you own your life, and that's a different perspective, I think that it's actually come to, bizarre as it is, that my life back in China, I was eliminated basically by the society, and then coming here, giving a chance. When I said to back the immigrant officer who tried to deport me and who caught me on the spot not speaking English when entering America, I said, my feet are on American soil. Yeah. And that, I really meant it, and that means a whole world to me. And from then on, every time I go, this is what's ruling me. When I see the homeless, I think I wasn't being nice, because the homeless was begging for my quarters. And I say, you, English, you, job.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, if I had to know English, I would have been given job. And I was actually happy with my Taiwanese boss at the restaurant. When I walk faster, she came behind me. She says, the house is now on fire.
Yeah.
Meaning, why are you walking so fast?
Yeah.
And if I slow down, she come out, park on my back again. She said, I did not hire you to be a lazy bone.
Yeah.
But I was happy because she let me know what I could improve, which was to find the balance. But if I were in China, I would not know why I was punished.
I'm fascinated by this distinction, which as someone who was born in America, I could never possibly know. The idea of looking at someone who is homeless and sort of saying, you don't realize what opportunities you have that I have never had. I'm wondering if in recent years, as you have lived here, you've adopted more of that attitude of empathizing or helping out someone who is homeless, or have your own standards of what it is to be down and out shifted, perhaps in the last 20 years or so.
Well, I feel like right now, I feel like I get carried away.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's wrong because I think I'm so strong-headed, judging people with where I coming from. That's where my conflict with my daughter come in.
Yeah.
When she was young, she was mine to influence, to nurture, to command in many ways. And she was my helper. She has to be the stabilizer on the other side of the ladder to hold up the drywall when I try to screw in the drilled screws in. She had no choice. But as she was, well, this is what I thought when she was born. The first moment I thought, the thought came to me was, she belonged to her glorious self. She did not belong to Communist Party of China. And she could say, I love you, Mama. I love you, Daddy. She doesn't have to say, I love you, Chairman Mao and Communist Party. Never say. Like, I never was able to say, I love you, Mom. Yeah. So I got carried away, like, making sure Lo Yan have the same gratitude and disrespect the fact that she was pickled in the American culture the moment she entered American school. And after middle school, high school, she said to me, she said, Mom, you know what your problem is. What you should do is to have compassion and no judgment. You judge, and I want you to do this. And you don't know the deprivation the American children gone through. Yes, you're in the labor camp, but you don't have a mother like an alcoholic, a drug mother. You were not a drug baby. You don't understand what these people, homeless people, for example, went through.
So how do you get past this judgment that goes so far into your own past? I mean, has your daughter been successful in steering you more towards her notion of judgment?
Well, then I learned to back off. And I thought, it's my propaganda, in a way, I believe if I don't get her on the board, whatever, it's not working, I just don't want to waste time. I start watching Dr. Phil, who says, result-oriented.
He's kind of, actually, you and Dr. Phil have a similar attitude in terms of getting off your duff, right?
Yeah. But I do feel that, you know, Americans take this country for granted. I feel that I made up my mind, I will not let that poison me. That attitude, that entitlement. You know, once you're American, you start to feel, I deserve this. And I thought to myself, before I enter to this country is beautiful, already built. Did you contribute anything to this beauty? You didn't. So you got to pay your due to contribute. And this is almost a communist training.
Yeah.
Serve the people with heart and soul, except that in America it works. In China, for hypocrisy.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Anchi. Do you think that there's a bare minimum of what people are entitled to, like basic needs? Do you think people should have a job, should have a home, should have health care? I mean, what's your thoughts on this? I'm curious.
Well, yes, in theory.
In theory.
Mm-hmm. But I think in real life, this is what I see through my daughter's life as a young American born in Chicago. I see that affluence and lead to corruption, and corruption leads to destruction. And Rome, in history, was going down the way that they were just enjoy their entitlement, and you start to lose your muscles, your defense, and your... China's joking, why do I even bother to build defense military? America's doing a good job destroying itself.
Yeah, but let's take national identity away from the question. On a basic human level, do you think that all humans, regardless of whether they come from China or America or any other country, should have, like, a bare minimum, that they're entitled to something? I'm just curious.
Yes, you're entitled to your humanity. Of course, in theory, again.
In theory.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Why do you...
Because as an immigrant, I knew.
Yeah.
Once my visa expires, you think I'm entitled to anything as a human? They deport me.
Yeah. So essentially, the in theory conditional clause here is really more of... Well, why wallow in idealism when someone who comes here could be deported in an instant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think your immigration officer will give me the compassion
that
say my feet are already on American soil? No. They find a clause that I was giving 6 months to master English and take a test and pass at the school that gave me the I-20, which was the School of the Arts of Chicago. If I fail that 6 months to master English, I will be reported and for deportation. And there is no, I don't see any way out. You see, in real life, it's just as cruel, cold. It's a matter of fact.
Well, I wanted to read a passage from your book in which you mm-hmm. describe how difficult it was for you to read English when you arrived here. You write, "Each page of my textbook had around 20 lines and about 30 words per line. This meant I had to open up my dictionary 200 times for each page. By the time I advanced to the third page, I was mentally exhausted." You worked long and hard in a Chinese labor camp. Where do you draw the line between hard work and exhaustion? Has the 8-hour day ever factored into your life? What do you do for downtime?
did not occur to me that I deserve a downtime. I just knew the difference. Where do I draw the line? The line is hope. That in China, I did not belong to myself. So there is no such hope as a personal, in terms of personal dream. In America, I knew that if now I'm a belong, my life belongs to me. See, this is a big, huge asset. That if I work every penny I put in the savings box that belong to me, that each virtue, each things I accumulate, it will get me out of debt. It will gradually. So it, almost with this thrilling feelings and then the happiness that I was be embracing the opportunity, like working for a painting on woman's nightgown and underpants for 50 cents a piece. Yeah. It was one of the jobs that I was blessed. I feel blessed.
Yeah.
So even with the quarter, I say, okay, I'm taking a Hofstede bus. My budget allows me $1.50. Now, from that would carry me from downtown to 31st Street. And from 31st Street to 43rd Street, which is south side of Chicago, is a dangerous area. Now, I need a quarter, extra quarter. But I would not use that extra quarter because I have to meet my budget. So I would walk that 10 blocks with a key that's key coming on my, holding the keys just in case I get, in case I got attacked.
Yeah.
Prepare to fight for myself. But that walk, still, it's a walk that I was fighting for myself, yeah. You see.
So let me ask you something. When was the first time in your life that you felt hope? Was it when you stepped on American soil, when you made it past that agent, or was it later, out of curiosity?
Two moments. It's very clear to me when I recall people asking, when's your happiest time in your life? Happiest time, number one, is the moment I got my visa. I recited the English introduction and translated from Chinese.
Yeah. 900 sentences.
Right. Without understanding what each sentence was, I just recited the same fashion I recited Mao quotations. I was good at reciting. This was a life and death for me. Because, you see, American by then only accept PhD candidate. And I was barely middle school graduate. And so I recite, my only thought was, I will not let the consul general interrupt me. If she or he did, they're going to find out I did not speak English. So I just like went to war, like holding an explosion, you know. So I just recited as loud as possible. And afterwards, I heard this word, okay. Yeah. And the curtain was closed on me, and I was moved to the next curtain. The Chinese secretary looked at me the sideways. She says, "You think you fooled the American consul? It's just Americans. You're lucky. Americans like people with crazy determination." So it's not like the consul did not know. She sensed it, but she thought I was crazy enough that I look likely, most likely I have the will to make it in America. So that was, I was given a chance. I remember that day I went home showing my father and mother the slip. They were shaking. My mother was leaning on my father. They did not have the courage to ask me, did you get the visa? When I broke the news I did, my mother just collapsed on her knees. And she said, I can't see, I cannot see, I cannot see. She just, mentally, she's been holding on and went blank at that moment. Yeah. My father was just totally pale because they knew I was dying in China, coughing blood. And I had a shadow on my lungs and a shadow on my liver and all these things. I did not know years, over the years. And when I came to America, I passed out in the elevator. And I was sent to St. Joseph Hospital. They thought I carried some like disease. I thought so myself too. So I quit the restaurant job immediately. I said, I don't want to give any disease to my customer. But the doctors couldn't find anything. They conclude it was depression.
Yeah.
So, and the second bad happy moment was the moment I got my green card.
Yeah.
I remember when I received the news, I was working in my attic. I just broke down and sobbed on my knees. I felt safe for the first time in my life, the green card. Because
yeah.
with the visa, I still knew that I would be caught at yeah. the custom. If they find out that I didn't speak English.
But once you had the green card, you can go to China and back as well.
Yes.
Which a lot of people just really aren't aware of. If you have a visa, you then have to reapply for it if you actually want to come back. And so it's no guarantee that you'll actually get back into America. I wanted to ask you, you brought up this woman who you worked for where you were painting flowers on panties and various fabrics. And she tried to swindle you basically by changing the rates. You would take things home and you did the math and you calculated how much you made. You quit that job when she was trying to bilk you. But then there's this incident you also describe in this book where these women say that they can get, you know, they can get money for you and they clean out your account. And you trust them, you know, without questioning them, whereas you had the knack of knowing, hey, this person's taking advantage of me. There's no reason for me to be involved with this relationship anymore in terms of employee-employer. So my question to you is, why do you think you were more willing to trust this second group of people as opposed to the woman? Was it because you were just sort of down and out at the time? Was it because you wanted to trust people? Why of this?
It has to do with where I come from. Yeah. I had no emu in terms of trusting. First of all, we were never on our own back in China. I mean, everything is arranged by the government. Even if you want to have surgery, the government's going to arrange it. And graduate from school, your future, everything's arranged. And mainly we did not trust China. Because I did not trust China, Chinese government, Chinese, my own people, then the other side of the grass, the hill, grass is greener. So when I came to America, I feel that America is number one in every way. So the fast food is the best food. I mean, how can America, they're so smart, they would feed themselves the best food, right?
And food got your daughter in trouble when you tried to give her that diet.
Right.
So maybe it's not so good.
Right. I had no immune system in terms of judging people. And I just have willingly to trust, because you see, you come here, you watch TV, you see Mr. Rogers and then Sesame Street, and you see Oprah Winfrey, and these are the images. Even when McDonald's promote commercial, it's hamburgers, it shows a picture of family, healthy children.
Yeah.
So it never dawned to me that I could be scammed. You know,
televisual images allowed you to feel an incredible trust for everything in America, you would say.
Right.
Yeah. That was really what led you to be more trusting. So when did you develop some street smarts? Because clearly you did along the way.
Yeah. After they cleared my account, I stood in front of the Chicago Bridgeport Public Library. I actually came 5 o'clock when they told me they would bring me the money. And I realized I was a fool. And I remember my mother says, the flies only parked on the eggs that cracked. So I realized my own greed, my own shortcoming, and then that my own failure in terms of this virtue, yeah. You know, my selfishness. It's just I totally see that I deserved it in a way, because if I hadn't been greedy, these flies would not be successful on clearing my account. So I learned to be smarter that way, the hard way.
Do you have trust issues even today? I mean, how do you trust people these days?
Oh, yeah. Being America, you trust people 100% and you trust people, you don't trust people 100%. And that balance, I found it amazing in American.
Yeah. So
because now I trust the only person in the mirror is my best friend.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you know, I reach out and give people the benefit of doubt. And I found Americans are capable of doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, you see these immigrant officers. They look at you, they embrace you with full humanity, full compassion. But in the back of their minds, you could be a spy. You could be a, you know.
Yeah. Well, look at Edward Snowden, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to also ask you about your association with music, which I found really interesting. You described that when you first went to Chicago, you looked at the Sears Tower and the sounds of Chinese opera filled your head. And eventually, when you were introduced to Michael Jackson became the sort of associative trigger. And I was curious to talk about this with you further. What is your relationship to music and the world? I mean, what tends to trigger music in your head? I was curious.
I found the power of music for the first time in Chicago subway, downtown, and the Union Station near. I was waiting, and the music was playing Stevie Wonder's. I just called to say I love you. I found myself in tears.
After Songs in the Key of Life.
Yeah. I understood that lyrics, and it just touched me so much. And after 3 years, I found that I couldn't really find a job in America. But I knew with what I have learned in America, I could make a big splash in China. And to bring, at least open a window, push the window open, and to let the American in. And I think the best way to get young people, just as this music got to me, is pop music. And so I wanted to do education in China through music, American music. And I found that was a very good bridge. So I went back to China and 3 years later and looked for a job. And I actually got signed up with the Shanghai Record Store.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because I think I was writing Red Azalea at the same time, and I was making up my mind to educate China about America. I went there, and I was a fresh air to China. And so I got the attention of CCTV, the central TV. They did a profile on me, and the Shanghai Television and Shanghai Eastern Television to go with this record contract for an album. And I composed myself, and you know who I would be imitating after, right? But then, when after, I think a Chinese, 33 newspapers, national newspaper reported me, they had a meeting. I learned this from the producer, who eventually came to me to explain why the TV profile, magazine profile was canceled. They say the boss of China says to the journalists, any of you read Red Azalea in its original English text.
Yeah.
And there was no hand was up. So they knew what to do. So they canceled everything. And the boss said, we don't want to make enemy with Aung Chi Minh, but we don't have to be her friend either. So with that cancellation, I knew the media would not be able to report me And without that, I would not have a successful career as a musician. So I wrote a letter to the head of Shanghai Record, Hu Zanyin. I said, I'm sorry that we spend the money and time on the record, producing the record, and I don't see a way out here. I'm returning to America. Mm-hmm. So that was my relationship with the music.
Yeah. But it's also interesting because I was thinking about what you say near the end of the book about how you relate to Pearl Buck. And of course, you've written a novel about Pearl Buck, about how she had to get rid of her Chinese roots. And by replacing Chinese opera with the likes of Stevie Wonder or Michael Jackson, you know, this leads me to ask, on a musical level or even on a broader level, you know, what's left of your Chinese roots? What do you keep, or do you have a hard time staring back?
I try to look at things on the glass half full. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the healthiest attitude I should adopt, and I would nurture that, look at the sunny side. I have both. I have both. Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, Broadway, Andrew Rapaloid, I love Broadway. I just took my daughter to see it every time here. I think I saw Fountain of the Opera and the Les Miserables and the Chicago and Evita probably 6 or 7 times, and Lion King. And these are the things that I think with a background with the Madame Mouse opera. And I see that. I thought if I were not a author today, I probably would be a composer, because I think I would use the background of Chinese music to combine with American Broadway and the pop music. And I think it's just... Pearl Buck was my hero. She's still my hero. I think, you see, if I were from China and trained as Chinese author, I would never have Pearl Buck's way of writing. Yeah. I think because of both my feet on both China and America, I was able to have a perspective. I mean, when I possess the Chinese material, but I have the writing way of writing, I embrace Pearl Buck's. You see, the interesting debate she had with a Chinese professor on the New York Times after Pearl Buck won the Nobel Prize was the Chinese professor protested. He was teaching at the Columbia University, I believe. And he said, why do you have to expose China's the lowest uneducated? Why can't you show the best of China, the 5% elite class of China, like who makes the Chinese classics? And Pearl Buck says, thank you for pointing that out. You just saved my stroke. That's exactly the point I want to make. I happen to be interested in the 95% of Chinese peasant. And for me, the same. And like Chinese said to me, who are you, An Qimi? You are not Mao's daughter. Your life just is playing as billions of Chinese. And I would give the same reply Pearl Buck gave. Mm-hmm. I happen to be one of the 99% of the nobodies.
Yeah. All this talk of music has me wondering if there's any room in the An Qimin musical diet for hip-hop or punk or metal or grunge or alternative rock of the 90s or anything like that, Kanye West.
Yeah.
Do you listen to any of that stuff, or is it pretty much what you listen to that awakened you when you first came in?
I tried to figure out Michael Jackson's moonwalk.
Oh, you did?
He almost tripped myself. And also, I
think this is an exclusive.
I learned the hip hop. Yeah, I can still do the moves.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. But I found myself a bit too old, and I'm into Latin, like a Zumba. I didn't have I just envy a woman with a butt, you know, big butt, swinging. And I think I just, I so much wanted to do that. And it rubbed off onto my daughter. And
she's salsa the one queen.
She's a salsa queen. And she's running Stanford University salsa troupe.
Oh, really?
She's a director. Huh. And she put up, and I feel like my extension when I saw her rock move.
Yes,
Yes.
Wow. I wanted to also talk about memory, because it seems to me that this really defines your life. I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about this, about how when you were in China, memorizing Mao's poems and his quotations, I mean, this allowed you to climb the ladder. When you worked at the Shanghai Film Studio, same thing. You were able to memorize all the scenes. When you were in America, memorizing words, really, I mean, this was pivotal to your settling here. I mean, how much of your progress and your success and your ability to open yourself up do you attribute to having a good memory? And what are your thoughts on the fact that, well, we live in an age in which we Google everything, and having a memory, remembering vital facts, vital names, vital words, well, it's not as much of a priority as it was before the smartphone generation. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, my thoughts are that everything is turning into sound bites and bullets, and then you just lose the lyrics, you lose the poetry, you lose the core, the beauty of your inner world, and the world that the only literature can deliver. That it's very sad. I think that it's so beautiful that you be able to spend time and be to have solitude, and that's a beauty. I think a lot of people lost ability to the muscle. They don't have that mental brain muscle to enjoy that. And it's a craft, it's an art. And I think you look back, part of most of your life as you age, like you reach my age, 56, and I look back, memory is what you left, what you have. I mean, bizarre as was, now I look back and the moment of panic when the camera was rolling at the Shanghai Film Studio, I was playing Madame Mao's heroine, and I did not know how to act. My only thought was, I must deliver. I don't want to be sent back to the labor camp. And then the lighting man says, stop. And the light bulb just went out. And the director and they would say, okay, go again. We need some more tears and more tears. And I said, I have no tears. Like when Mao died, I had no tear. I had to pretend to be crying, to be sad for him. I have to put hands on my face and looking, checking through my fingers to see if other people feel the same, that are they glad for Mao's passing or they're sad. All these things that are coming, waving, the texture, and it's so rich. It's like a collage. And that's the life. It's fantastic. It's just... It's just the richness of it. I mean, easy for me to say it right now because I survived.
When did you associate, though, memory with just progressing or being able to not be in a labor camp or not being someone who is going to be deported because you didn't learn English in 6 months? When was memory that very element that for you? When did you know it was that or nothing?
When I developed an American perspective, when I was well-fed and I can afford to mediate and I meditate to actually put everything in a poetic contest.
So so basically the way to develop a great memory is to be well-fed and stay humble.
Yes.
I wanted to talk about Chigu, your first husband, with whom you bought a fixer-upper. Here was a guy... He slept until noon, didn't even have a ring when the judge married you, didn't express his love for you, had you work on the building when you were pregnant while he slept. He doesn't exactly come across very well in the book, yet you managed to also trick him by getting him to sign this paper in which you took Lorianne, your daughter, to California, but you didn't specify a return date. I'm wondering if Chigu can be entirely blamed for his actions in this marriage. I mean, relationships often take two, obviously, for something to fall apart. How do you mediate, in this case, between his clear indiscretions and your own screw-ups? I mean, you know, what are the good things you could say about Chigu?
It's my own screw-up,
yeah.
First of all. Second was, I kept telling my daughter, I said, you must understand my vision, a version of Chico is from a divorced wife.
Yeah.
So you keep in mind, I can't say, it's impossible for me to say good things about him, otherwise I would not divorce him. So you have that perspective, you know I'm limited. And I want you to go and find out your own version. This is the first thing. And also, I think the reason I portray Chico, I wanted to do a fair job, because he represents a very big group of immigrants who come here for a different American dream.
Yeah.
Because you see his status. He come from China. In China, his house, his old house, his grandfather's house, was taken by Mao as Mao's house. So their family is well-to-do enough. He's an upper class, a very classic from Hangzhou. He has a very different pursuit in life. He's a Taoist and a Zen master. His view of life, today he's a professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And he's a guru in some sort. His life is, his life, I basically tied him onto my train. It wasn't what he wanted. He came to America to seek for freedom. And he believed that his way should also succeed. And my way should not be the only way. Which he just proved himself that today he is a successful professor of art. If he had compromised and did what I asked of him, which is to bring home by doing a waitering job, $15,000 a year, and he would never have what he had today.
Yeah.
And so that said, I would say that, so I have to respect his approach of American dream. It's very different from me. I thought he deserved a voice too. But my...
Contact him to show him the book before you wrote about it?
Publisher, my editor didn't want me to change name because he can sue me.
Oh, yeah.
So I showed him all the chapters that relate to him. Mm-hmm. And he read it. It's amazing. He says, I want you to use my own name because the way you wrote, there's nothing I should be ashamed of our past.
Really?
I still believe that I did not offer you a ring does not mean I didn't have feelings for you. It's just my way of the Chinese way.
Yeah.
And with my second woman, wife, I still don't have a ring. He almost on purpose defied the traditional way of thing. And then this is a very interesting comment. When I was in Chicago at the Printers Row last week, his wife said, I just finished your book. The Chico character in the book is the man I don't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Now, isn't that great perspective? I thank her for offering me. That's the love is beholder of the eyes, in the eyes of beholder. And it's either Chico changed a little bit, which I don't believe. He's not the type who wanted to change. I mean, he will make his effort. But also, he and I, as immigrants, we just push it together by life and the hardship. He never was in love with me. He would not do what he did for his wife, the woman, today's wife, that he's in love with. And his woman, who is in love with him, did not see what I see. So you see the version of stories, mine is just mine. And it really humbles me that way, too. And talk about the child, Lorianne, our daughter, I understood that if I took her away, that I would be arrested as a kidnap.
Yeah.
The law says 50 miles away from each other for the sake of a child. So I manipulated and threw Chico's mother. You see, for me, to get a good evaluation from my mother, how I was doing as a daughter-in-law was important to me. So today, my ex-in-law said to me that we lost a daughter-in-law, but we gained a daughter. At the time of my manipulation, I tried to move to California. Because I saw when Chico brought Lorianne to the kindergarten teacher says, are you here for lunch? So the child's missing early morning class all the time. I knew that would ruin Lorianne's life. So I asked my mother-in-law. I said, Chico just married. You want him to live with me or you? And they have the wife brought a son who was 2 years older, a teenager then. And who do you want your granddaughter to live with, me or Chico?
Yeah.
And then my mother-in-law says, you. As a woman, I understand why you wanted to divorce Chico. But as a mother for Chico, I could only take my son's side. But for Loyan's sake, I want her to live with you. And I said, what about Chico? She says, I deal with it. I deal with him. So I
was really curious, both you and Chico had the fixer-upper, and later on there's a building that you're also doing a fixer-upper with. Why was being a landlord such an important part of making it here in America?
I would rather have an office job.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
My English wasn't... I have an accent, as sure, you can detect, sure. And nobody hired me.
So it was because you couldn't get a job and that this represented the only way? Yeah. So but why was it property owning that you saw as the sort of great step to survive?
It was no other options.
Yeah.
And I had a down payment from Red Azalea.
Yeah.
So I was able to sell my labor. And that's the only thing that I see I could sell.
You talk also about, in the second building you own, you have this couple comes, and because you answer the email in a way that is not exactly friendly to the laws that protect tenants, you then have someone hassle you to get fined for this. You're also, you know, quite hard sometimes on some of the, you know, the so-called deadbeats who actually rented from you in these buildings. This may relate to my question earlier about whether people should have basic rights, but I mean, obviously it's
at whose expense? Their rights, they're being deadbeats, and they at the American taxpayers' cost, their expenses. Do you think that's right?
I think that when you have a law that is designed to protect tenants, rightfully, because there are a lot of slumlords and there are a lot of landlords who take advantage of tenants, obviously some landlords who are well-meaning, who actually, I mean, there's always going to be people who are going to fall on the other side of a law's noble intent. But nevertheless, you know, do you think some of these laws are worth upholding? Maybe I'm asking you about tenant rights. what do you feel about this? Do you feel that you got? I mean, it seems to me that you may have gotten needlessly burned here. But on the other hand, don't tenants deserve safety and non-discrimination?
Right. I think that I can only tell my own story that I just being right now. I feel guilty that being sued and with all these my fellow people that's also got sued, their garbage man, their postman, their fireman, teachers retired, this their retirement, and they're in the class and was being quote unquote educated into being smarter. Basically is just to play the game. I did not play the game. I believe in sincerity. For example, I like the tenants, but their young son was pulling out, pulling out the curtain, that's vertical curtain, hurt them. And I said, if we can work out a plan, I change the curtain, the plastic things into curtain, and I can rent it to you. And they sued me just upon that for this discrimination. And they, when they write the complaint, they already know that they say, Auntie, the landlord violated code such and such.
Yeah.
They know the number. So you know these people have done it. They know how to get to me. And I regretted I did not listen to Lorian says, Mom, just don't answer the email.
Yeah.
Then you'll be safe. And I thought...
This goes back to the trust issue we were talking about.
Yeah, and I thought people faxed me all this, at least that they deserve my thinking.
Yeah.
What troubling me. Right. And I just thought, now I know so well to protect myself, because by the end, I knew that the last tenants came to me and they don't care if bank was trying to foreclose my property because nobody paying the rent. And the tenant says, I don't want to be the last one pay the rent.
Yeah.
And other people come up with the excuses. Oh, my husband's a roofer who fell off the roof and couldn't pay, and then you have a child have a diabetes, couldn't pay, and all the excuses, and eventually not, then I hire a white man, and they all of a sudden they have no problem paying.
Yeah.
And it's just such a lesson. I see how people milk the system firsthand. And I think I have a eternal vision. I don't think I have any right to say that this represents anybody else. It just, I had a trouble I have to discuss with my daughter, who crying over, he said, why should I be the person, be landlord's kid, and who carry the concrete bag 30 pounds day in and day out, and working to clean the sewage, and even with a bottle of shampoo cannot get rid of a stink in my hair. Yeah. I just want American childhood.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm asking too much. And Jamaica's kids have everything. Animals, skating board, games, their own room, everything. And I've been trying to teach my daughter about, like, the Chinese. So basically, it's a propaganda movies. All the landlords are terrible people. And she said, that's propaganda. You are the real life landlord. See where it get you.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, just because it's been in the headlines lately, what your thoughts are on present Sino-American relations. I mean, here we have the U.S. spying on China, China spying on the U.S. Here we have a situation in which, of course, China is the U.S.'s largest foreign creditor. Do you have any thoughts on how this is going to play out? I mean, it's not looking especially good right now.
Yeah, I like to reply that question with Probuck said in 1967. She was interviewed, and she says, it's all depend on America.
Mm.
The way how American play this thing, China can be wonderful friend and frightful enemy. And I share that view today is to be true. Because for all these years, nobody took Probuck's advice. And still you don't. And I see throughout my daughter's textbooks, there's very little about China. And a lot of things that readers don't even, they have a hard time believe what I wrote about Opium War and Allied invasion China 1900. People says I had a monstrous imagination. And I'm thinking, without knowing where China's coming from, you have no way to know where China's going. And you just tell me that I had an imagination and you're unwilling to know about China. And this is about America. And the China's thing is like, we cannot show our darkness. We're going to ban red azalea. And we have been banning red azalea, because portion of red azalea is about the dark side of China. And China wants to present its image during the 2008 Olympics.
Yeah.
Flawless, which is threatening, because that's so unreal. Americans see that the more you project yourself as perfect, and the less trust we have on you. So that miscommunication just go. Because China's panicking says, if I show more of my flaw, you're going to demonize me even further. And China did not understand. If only you show that you're just as human, you're just as flawed as American, and you're just transparent, don't be ashamed of that something inside of the Communist Party is not working, you might gain more understanding.
On the other hand, America is also very good about not being especially transparent about, say, spying on its citizens. So it's almost like we have a yin-yang here between China and America. Both are guilty of similar sins, I suppose, in terms of perception and how we portray ourselves to the outside world.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good note to close this conversation on. Anchi, it was a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for making time for me during your very hectic schedule.
Thank you, Ed.
Fantastic. All right.